From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. So many faith stories this week of Good Friday and Easter, of Passover and the story of Jews and Egypt, Moses and Exodus. Celebrated historian Simon Shama is telling the long story of Jewish history lately, 3,000 years, bitterness and sweetness. In this week of Passover and anti-Semitic gunfire in America, he's with us. This hour On Point, the story of the Jews with Simon Shama, and we'll touch down later in the hour for the latest from Pope Francis. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What's your question for Simon Shama on the story, the history of the Jews? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Simon Shama joins me now from New York, professor of art history and history at Columbia University. His five-part television series, The Story of the Jews, produced by the BBC, has just run on PBS. The first of his two-volume companion histories, The Story of the Jews, Finding the Words, 1000 BC to 1492 AD, has just been published. Simon Shama, welcome back to On Point.
Well, thank you, Tom. Chag Sameach. Happy festival to you.
Yes, and to you. Seders, Passover observances all over the country, all over the world.
Well, in the White House, too.
In my own house a couple of years ago when friends were up from New York and needed a good table.
I don't know. Judaism sometimes or Jewishness goes global. When I was growing up and bagels were rock hard in my bit of London. I never dreamt they'd be an international global commodity.
And now there they are.
Everywhere, yes.
You've got the big series many people have been watching on public television long before Sin, seen on the BBC in the UK, and I'm sure they'll be watching it elsewhere as well. You've got this wonderful big volume I've just been through and another still to come. Mm-hmm. Here we are. You know, we'll have, I don't know, maybe half an hour to talk about this. How do you begin to wade into Jewish history 3,000 years?
Now, I thought you were going to do that for me. Actually,
that would be easy, wouldn't it?
You wade in, like the Bible says, in the beginning.
I got to be in the beginning part. Yeah. I mean, you somehow did it in 5 hours, so you're a master at giving condensation here. I mean, maybe let me ask you this. You say at one point here in early on in the book that tells a couple of thousand years of this history here, that what the Jews have lived through has been the most intense version known to human history of adversities endured by other peoples as well. Why the most intense version when you talk about adversity in the Jews?
Well, I mean, the most recalcitrant version, certainly, because the Jews don't go away. I mean, it's assumed by triumphant societies and military cultures that try and get rid of them, the last, of course, being the Holocaust, that they will then disappear. But because the Jews invent a portable form of their culture in the first place when facing the Assyrians and the Babylonians and the Romans, in other words, the Bible itself, which could be moved along with them, they stubbornly did endure and they found a way to live an existence thrown right across the world and imprinted with many different kind of cultures from India to Spain to Northern Europe to the Americas, and yet still retain a kind of common core of that story and those ethical norms. So there was a man who was an early Zionist called Dr. Leo Pinsker living in Odessa. Odessa, very much on one's mind right
Ukraine,
now.
Ukraine, yeah.
Yes, exactly. And Pinsker said that part of the problem about Russian anti-Semitism, as it then was and conceivably might still be, is that the Jews were treated like phantoms. They should have disappeared, but they were still walking like ghosts among us. And he said that other people don't like ghosts very much and constantly try to get rid of them. So you have, you know, from the Jewish side, you have this miracle of endurance by living the life of words, of religion, of the mind, of the spiritual imagination, all things that cannot be destroyed by mere military force. On the other hand, you have a commensurate fury against them for pretty much, you know, that same reason. I mean, the fact that they managed to survive with extraordinarily complicated linked networks of families and language and religion in all those different parts of the world automatically gives rise to a notion that there's some sort of conspiracy going on.
It is the week of Passover. Take us back to origin stories. You clearly, in the pages of your history, have a lot of respect for scripture and Talmudic and biblical, but you are a historian as well. Give us the origin story, and what about all the talk of enslavement and freedom in the historical route?
Well, the first thing to say, not to be a party pooper to my fellow Jews, is that the story of the Exodus from Egypt was written at least half a millennium after it might have happened. And in fact, the very first mention of the word Israel in any historically documented form outside the Bible is the opposite from the drowning of Pharaoh's armies in the Red Sea. It's a mention in a stone victory inscription by the Pharaoh Meneptah in the 13th century BC that Israel is no more, his seed are scattered. Which one wants to say, good luck to that one, Buster, actually, because his seed was very definitely not no more. But just because actually we don't have any rock-hard archaeological evidence of the Exodus doesn't necessarily mean it didn't happen. And a lot of Bible scholars have pointed out, and this is extremely beautiful, that some of the archaic songs that occur in the first five books of Moses, particularly the Song of Miriam, which celebrates the triumph over the Egyptian armies drowned in the Red Sea, have a relationship to other songs of the sea, but are very, very old indeed, maybe as old as the 12th and 11th century BC. So something very ancient, some mythology, some fundamental story about slavery and freedom is going on. Then it's recapitulated many hundreds of years later and woven into the form of the Bible. What is remarkable about it is if you think about other myths of origins, other stories and chronicles, they're almost certainly not about having been enslaved. They're not about the weak, the impoverished, the helpless. They tend to be the deeds of the mighty. And I think that's partly why the Exodus story has such an extraordinary resonance, and not just for Jews. That's why, the president is celebrating it in the White House. It had an incredible impact on the civil rights movement, of course.
The monotheism of Judaism was unprecedented, I guess, as it emerged.
Well, again, we're back to Egypt, not entirely, because the pharaoh Akhenaten, you remember, abolishes plural paganism in favor of a single, faceless, formless sun god with which he's intimately and divinely connected. But what happens to Akhenaten, of course, actually, is that he disappears and his single monotheistic god disappears with him. And what's very different about Judaism is that an invisible god, who Moses gets a glimpse of his back, and of course the only part that really is functionally available of this formless, faceless, invisible God is the moving finger, very significantly a finger that is writing down words of the Ten Commandments. And that is brand new, and it takes a while for it to be an exclusive God. Not till the end of the book of Isaiah do you have a sense in which there is just one God supreme. The commandments say, thou shalt have no other gods before me, which rather implies there was a queue of them somewhere else, a line of them somewhere else.
What in your assessment has it meant to Judaism to be in its monotheism, sort of the root or precursor of these two very large religions, Christianity and Islam?
Well, I think the monotheistic, the relationship with the other monotheisms then became, of course, very difficult because there's a certain point at which those who are the editors of the Bible, those who are the sages and the early teachers and rabbis, believe that the age of prophecy is ended. That's really pretty much concluded a century before the appearance of Jesus of Nazareth. So the problem simply for Jews at that point, professing Judaism, is to keep the integrity and the peculiarity of their own ethical teachings completely intact. The big problem, though, is for the other religions. I think Jews would probably say that the issue is really why Christianity chose not just to say that Judaism was mistaken, as Christianity certainly did, but also rather more ominously and in a more sinister way to actually demonize the Jews by the 3rd and 4th century, to say that the Jews are dangerous companions of demons and synagogues are sinister places from which you wouldn't emerge intact. Muhammad, of course, actually is entirely another story. He expected to be thoroughly welcomed in a city which became Medina, was then called Yathrib in the 7th century, because so much of what he was teaching was part of the the Old Testament, and many of the prescribed rituals, what you do to make halal meat, for example. Originally, Muslims prayed in the direction of Jerusalem. He expected there to be a kind of a like-minded communion of monotheists. And when, in fact, he was attacked by the leaders of the Jewish community, including very vociferous poets, it all went wrong.
We're talking in this week of Passover and anti-Semitic gunfire about the history of the Jews with celebrated historian Simon Shama. His work has been all over public television. His first volume of a two-volume set, The Story of the Jews, Finding the Word, up to 1492, and we'll look at that date, is out. Simon Shama, please stand by in New York. A little Mendelssohn behind us and a story there. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In a week of Passover and anti-Semitic gunfire, we're talking this hour about the history of the Jews with celebrated historian Simon Shama, who joins us today from New York. His new book, first of two volumes, The Story of the Jews, Finding the Word, 1000 BC to 1492 AD, is just out. Another volume coming this fall. His big series has just been on television here and abroad. At the White House during Easter prayer breakfast on Monday, President Obama spoke out against the anti-Semitic attacks this week when a man opened fire in Overland Park outside Kansas City at two Jewish centers, killing three people, Christians, it turned out.
As Jews were preparing to celebrate Passover, as Christians were observing Palm Sunday, makes this tragedy all the more painful. And today, as Passover begins, we're seeing a number of synagogues and Jewish community centers take added security precautions. Nobody should have to worry about their security when gathering with their fellow believers. No one should ever have to fear for their safety when they go to pray.
And yet people have, Jews certainly have, for a long, long time. Simon Shama, lots of callers for you. If I may, Rod in Salem, Massachusetts, you're on the air with Simon Shama.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question has to do with how the Jews got to Eastern Europe. In my family and in the family of practically every Jew I know, our grandparents came from, whether it be Russia, Poland, Lithuania, they spoke Yiddish, sometimes Russian. How did they get there from, let's say, the Middle East? And why is it that they spoke Yiddish, which is a Germanic language and not some kind of a Slavic language?
You've rather brilliantly answered your own question, Rod, actually. They came from Germany initially, from the Rhineland. There are medieval settlements of Jews in Rhineland and France. And when there are a series of expulsions and violent assaults in southwest Germany, for example, they moved towards one of the areas, what was then the Kingdom of Poland and Lithuania, which was actually, we're talking about the 13th and 14th century, one of the more tolerant places to be able to go to. They moved there as merchants, as tax farmers. And then there was simply a huge demographic expansion in the 17th and 18th century, natural population increase. So Judeo-German, or Yiddish as it's called, a kind of compound of Hebrew and German, German, but written in Hebrew characters, actually predates the settlement in Eastern Europe itself.
If I may sort of anticipate Rod's thinking as you describe that, I mean, take us back further then. The path from the Middle East, from ancient Israel to the Rhineland, for that matter. I mean, you have wonderful maps in the back of the book. You've got here the Jewish world revealed in the Cairo Geniza. Is that how you pronounce it? All
yes,
over the Mediterranean
indeed.
On into Spain
it's
and all over Europe.
Flung.
Just describe that migration. Well, was it Roman Empire path?
Yes, it is. Yes, again. Yes, you're all such good historians, and I don't mean that patronizingly at all. Indeed, it was exactly the Roman Empire. But the important thing to stress is that we now know, which changes the story I grew up with as a child, that it wasn't that all people professing Israelite religion and Judaism were concentrated in Palestine, and then after the destruction of the temple in 70 AD were suddenly kind of thrown to the winds. There was a good deal of migration into the Aegean, for example. There are classical Greek synagogues, which are extremely old, on the island of Delos, and in Anatolia, well before the destruction of Herod's temple. So the Jews, as a sort of famous suitcase people, both seeking opportunity and sanctuary, that story of globetrotting happens really early on. And under the Roman Empire, they do travel very far indeed, right through what's now Tunisia, to Spain, and there they stay. When the Roman Empire collapses, they stay into Christian Visigothic Spain, and then it becomes gradually Islamic Spain. So these sort of networks into classical Mediterranean and gradually into Northern Europe, when access is open to them, are very early indeed. We know of one group who were known as Radamanite merchants, who are already traveling very long distances and going from small Jewish community to Jewish community in the 7th and 8th century AD.
You know, you have seen over the sweep of time, and I wonder if you can distill the distinction for us between circumstances once out of ancient Israel in which Jews were accepted and embraced, circumstances in which they tended to be persecuted and driven out. Are there patterns?
Well, earlier on you alluded, Tom, exactly rightly to this sort of problematic triangular relationship between Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. And it changes. One tends to think, well, Christian society, not least because there are so many expulsions from France and terrible one from England in 1290, tends to be a very difficult place for Jews to live. They're confined to certain kind of Jewish districts and quarters, whereas the Islamic world is much more open. In some respects, that's absolutely true. You were very definitely, as were Christians, a second-class citizen in the Islamic world, and you were obliged to wear distinctions of dress. You couldn't ride a horse. You couldn't carry weapons. Nonetheless, you could live where you wanted, and you could pretty much practice any occupation that you chose. And that was not true in the Christian world. The experience of Jews in the Islamic world in Spain was not completely free of occasional massacre, but it's fair to say that Jews and Muslims could share streets. They could even live in the same house. They often share businesses. So the difference is, of course, plain and stark, it was a problem for Christianity that the Jews were responsible for the crucifixion of the Savior. But even within Christian society, there were two possible views about that. And for a long time, a more benevolent view that the Jews, bearers of witness to their own mistakes, needed to be kept around, if only to be there for their own eventual conversion. And something really rather grim and peculiar happens in the High Middle Ages, begun by the preaching orders of the friars, Dominicans in particular, and Franciscans to some extent as well, where the dangers that Jews, absolutely obstinately perverse and obtuse culture, the dangers seem to outweigh the possible benefits of their eventual conversion. And synagogues begun to be invaded by ranting, preaching friars. Hmm. And from the First Crusades on, Jews are physically vulnerable to violent attack.
What was that I mean, even then, just take Christendom then, as it was known. What about variations in degree of embrace or ostracism, isolation within Christendom?
Well,
all Jews were not beyond the pale at all times.
No, absolutely not. That's true. And, you know, as I say in one of the programs, actually, that Jewish money was, you know, gratefully received to build abbeys and cathedrals in England as well. But very importantly, and I'm writing about this a lot in Volume 2, there's an extraordinary kind of almost honeymoon between Christian theologians who are very interested in Hebrew, and indeed in the Kabbalah during the Renaissance, and rabbis who prepared to teach them. There are very moving moments in the early 16th century, which on the whole, because of the Counter-Reformation, was not a great time to be Jewish in the Christian world, but there are wonderfully moving moments of cardinals and even popes being befriended by and carrying on a correspondence or even living tutorials, sharing the same Hebrew and Kabbalistic texts.
You have this wonderful kind of side-by-side of 1492 is the end of your first volume, and you have Columbus, of course, setting off for the New World, and on his ship, the Santa Maria, he has... scientific documents from a Jewish rabbi that he's carrying to help him, I guess, navigate these seas at the same time that there are kind of traffic jams he's facing getting out of Spain and Portugal because so many Jews are being expelled from Spain.
Right. There is a wonderful sense of can't do without them, better get rid of them, happening at the same time with other people. And it's an extraordinary phenomenon. Columbus also takes Fernando Torres, who's a recent and very expedient convert, as a Hebrew translator, because Columbus is, of course, expecting to find the East. He's expecting to find the Indies, in other words, India, by sailing west. And one thing which you hoped you were going to find would be the lost tribes of Israel. So obviously you're going to need a Hebrew translator. The Hebrew translator is not much use when he gets to the Caribbean, as it turns out.
What was he actually using the astronomy of Rabbi Abraham?
Well, it was Abraham Zacuto. Certainly, it was a latitudinal. It established. I'm very bad at this kind of navigational maths. It won't shock you to hear, Tom.
All right, yes.
But it established your place exactly in latitudes. The Jews, because they are so far flung, actually do need to be aware of navigation.
Let's go to Murph calling from Nantucket. Hello, Murph. You're on the air with Simon Shama.
Hey, Tom. I'm curious, and I want to preface this by stating, and I don't mean this stereotypically, every time I ask a person, probably 9 times out of 10, I should say, of their ethnic background and their of the Jewish religion, they reply that they're Jewish, as opposed to German Jew, Israeli Jew, English Jew. And I'm wondering, historically, is that because they've never really had a home, being displaced and persecuted? And I'll take my reply off the air. Thank you.
Simon, what do you say to that?
Well, I don't think, I'm surprised that they all say that, actually. But if you say, you know, if someone were to ask me, what am I? I'd say, well, I'm a New Yorker, even though I sound, so I'm a Londoner.
I mean, we should acknowledge it.
I'm a Jew who happens to live in New York.
Yeah, but it's a freighted question. This has been a subject of tension over forever.
It is. There was simply horrible not to jump to a moment of gloom and misery. But quite apart from the lunatic who opened up, you know, fire, actually seriously, hitting two
outside
Christians.
Kansas City.
Yeah, absolutely terrible. There's one thing you hate more than an anti-Semite. It's an incompetent anti-Semite, really. You know, doesn't know what he's
shouting
doing.
But much Hitler more, from the back of a police car.
Yes, exactly. Jeez. That is just grotesque. More upsetting are 17,000 people marching through the streets of Paris saying, Jews, get out of France. And just this morning, it's not confirmed by other sources, but it's a very ominous piece of news. In Haaretz, the left-leaning Israeli newspaper, showed a photo of a notice posted, I think, at Donetsk, actually, next to a synagogue.
Eastern Ukraine.
Ordering... Yeah, do you know this story? I mean, ordering Jews to register their names and their property and their real estate because it was said that the Jewish community in eastern Ukraine is far too friendly to the government in Kiev, on penalty of losing their citizenship, exactly where one assumes in the Republic of Donetsk, or being deported. And I mean, this is obviously crazed, and you know, nobody knows who's responsible, but there's no doubt about the authenticity of this horrible little document. And that, of course, sends the most appalling shiver down one's spine. So it's always possible that people are pointed out as somehow Jews and therefore not properly loyal to the place where they live. That's an old and hideous story.
Sarah, in Nashville, Tennessee. Sarah, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Could you ask your speaker about the background of the Jews in Iran? I'm from Iran originally, and I'm very interested in the history of that part of the world. And I would like to know if the Jews in Iran have the Jewish bloodline, or are they Persian origin?
Interesting. Wow. On a couple levels. Bloodline, yeah. Is that even... Does that make sense?
I don't know. I mean, it would need to have DNA testing, I guess, to do a swab. But the settlement is incredibly ancient. I mean, it goes back to biblical times, of course, actually, because after the Babylonian destruction of the kingdom of Judea, Jews are, you know, moved to Mesopotamia. Mesopotamia is a central part of what becomes the then Zoroastrian, the Sasanian Persian Empire. The Talmud is actually created under the benevolent aegis of the Persian Empire at that time, the pre-Islamic Persian Empire. So the settlement of the Jews in the Persian world is extraordinarily ancient. In fact, my book, begins in Persian-ruled Egypt, where the Jews are being deployed as tough guy customs post people down on the border between Egypt and Nubia. So the relationship, it's often thought that, the rabbis and Zoroastrians had much in common. And some of the rituals of purification, for example, are indeed extremely similar. So there was a very interesting instance of a kind of fertile cross-cultural relationship between ancient Persia and Judaism. And the community is still one of the biggest communities, notwithstanding difficulties with Israel, one of the largest communities in the Middle East outside Israel. I think there are 25 or 30,000 Jews in Iran, and the government is always enormous pains to say what a good time Jews have in the Republic of Iran, and that they're not discriminated against because of being tainted by Zionism or whatever. Who knows if that's true or not?
That's the word. We went out of the last segment with Mendelssohn. There's a story there. We're going to go out of this segment in just a minute and a half here with Yip Harburg's Somewhere Over the Rainbow. Of course, he was son of Jewish immigrants from Russia. Mendelssohn, well, he has a very special story, as you remind us. Born into a Jewish family, but baptized as a Christian. What do you make of the arc from, here's Mendelssohn in 1809, Yip Harburg in 20th century America?
Right. Well, Mendelssohn wasn't just born into a Jewish family. His grandfather, Moses Mendelssohn, is the first sort of intellectual Jewish celebrity, really, in the non-Jewish world. He teams up with a brilliant philosophical writer and playwright called Lessing, Gotthold Lessing. Mm. And Lessing writes a play which is the kind of correction to The Merchant of Venice. Instead of the hideous and villainous Shylock, there's a figure in the play called Nathan the Wise, who is a thinly disguised version of Moses Mendelssohn. Moses Mendelssohn believed you could be a good German drenched in Goethe and in the German classics and still be a Jew. And, you know, this companionship between them was a demonstration of that. His son, Abraham, who's a banker, however, is not quite so sure. And he's the one who does the baptism. And his son, Felix, and indeed his daughter, Fanny, are composers. But they still want to call themselves not Bartholdy, as their father wanted, to forget the Jewish roots, but Mendelssohn Bartholdy. So you couldn't quite take the Jew out of the Mendelssohns.
It's a long story and quite a passage just in this, from Mendelssohn's suppressed identity there to Yip Harburg and what feels like such an all-American piece of music, of course, Somewhere Over the Rainbow. Simon Chalmers writing about 3,000 years of Jewish history. His latest volume out is the story of the Jews finding the word 1000 BC to 1492 AD. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Fly beyond the rainbow. Why, oh, why can't I?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In a week of Passover and anti-Semitic gunfire, we're talking this hour about the history of the Jews with celebrated historian Simon Shama. Two-volume History of the Jews. First volume is out now, second coming this fall, and of course has been his big TV documentary. We'll talk later in this hour, just in a few minutes, about, we'll touch anyway, the world of Pope Francis and his impact on the church. It's just a moment with Simon Shama, but a good week and a good moment to touch in with him. Here's a little bit from episode one of his five-part TV documentary series, The Story of the Jews. It's Passover here, and Simon Shama is with guests around the Seder table, reading from the Haggadah and discussing what it means to be Jewish.
Difference exposes you.
Absolutely.
And that you pay a price for your differentiation, but you can also celebrate your emancipation and your self-determination.
And have a sense of humor.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, is Jewish culture always expecting the worst?
Yes.
Oh, Lily. Yes, darling. Yeah, is that?
I just thought it was realistic.
Yeah.
The Jewish imagination is paranoia confirmed by history.
The Seder table of Simon Shama, you hear him in the midst of his guests there. He joins us today from New York. Our time is short, over 3,000 years of history, but we give it our best. Harry in Burlington, Vermont, you're on with Simon Shama.
Oh, thanks for taking my call, Tom. It's an honor to talk to you. I've been a fan of Mr. Shama's art writing for many years.
Yes.
But I have a question regarding, I wanted to talk a little bit about, I've always been sort of fascinated by the brilliant contributions by Jewish artists, specifically post-World War II. It seems that this country has really benefited immensely by their contributions, in art, painting, film, dance, even humor. Can you maybe elaborate a little bit on this history for me?
Well, there are two things to be said. Thank you very much for the question. Is that I said earlier that actually, if you have everything else stripped from you, institutions, your patch of real estate, politics, an army, then you tend to live in what's left to you, namely a set of ethical norms, thinking about the good, just, righteous, charitable life. And that's what Jews did with perforce had to do. But then they began to feel that it was an absolute obligation to teach their children in that particular way. I'll just, because since you raised the point, let's take one particular example, that of Mark Rothko. Mark Rothko, who one thinks of as so much deeply in the world of abstract expressionism, was in fact originally a Hebrew teacher in Brooklyn. He wasn't a religious person in any kind of way of formal observation, but he was absolutely adamant that his beautiful, shimmering, extraordinary panels of color were meant as a meditative exercise and were not just simply decorative or ornamental. He actually hated the word abstract. So that there's a good example of someone precisely working at a time of materialist rapture, the 1950s, consumerist. And, you know, he was still in a way Rabbi Hebrew teacher Rothko, kind of actually inveighing against the shallowness of the material life, and that indeed was extremely Jewish.
Harry asks in particular about that post-World War II period, and of course that comes with on the heels of the worst, the Holocaust. Do you see a dynamic connection between that terrible losses of the Holocaust and that explosion of
arts. I think that, you know, one tends to, it's often said that Jewish history shouldn't just be an endless cycle of calamity, a veil of tears. Mm. And the flip side of that is, of course, that Jewish experience teaches you to take hold of life with a maximum intensity, urgency, vitality, and to celebrate it as well. Nobody, least of all me, as a little kid growing up in Britain in the 1950s, mm-hmm. thought that the great issue of our day, other than the death of the planet, would be how do peoples of different beliefs manage to share the same patch of living space without the obligation of trying to oppress or exterminate each other.
Yeah.
On that, Jews have something to say. And the way they do it when they come out of something as horrifically annihilating as the Holocaust, to say, you've killed our bodies, but our spirit, our imagination still lives.
Harry, I appreciate your call. And let me get one more, if I may, for Simon Schama, out with his book and his five-part series on the story of the Jews. Michael in Beaufort, North Carolina. Michael, thank you for calling. You're on with Simon Schama.
Hi, Tom and Simon. I watched Hi. The 5 hours of the series, and I really enjoyed them. But I do want to ask you who they were addressed to, because I think that rather than being the story of the Jews, it's a story of the Jews.
Yes.
And the thing that I missed some was some of the story from within, the struggle, for example, the Geniza doesn't mention Maimonides, the Hasidim right. story doesn't mention right. the struggles within the community, which were major, and that sort of stuff. So I'm wondering
guilty as charged. Well, in a first instance, you're absolutely right, but I would, without, you know, hustling you, say, buy the book.
Very much so. Geniza, Maimonides, very much there in the book.
Yeah, it's the book is full of it, actually. And, you know, television is a brutal and vulgar disciplinarian. You have to obey the narrative arc, and you have to make terrible decisions. So in the first instance, the answer to your question, it was addressed with hope to the Jewish community, but overwhelmingly to people who are not Jewish, whose idea of Jewish history is it's just about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict or just about the Holocaust. I wanted to say, welcome non-Jews, and say, it's appropriate for this week, Tom, and thank you for having me on, is that it's your story as much as it's ours.
Meaning? It's all woven together?
Jews have never lived separately unless they've been forced to live separately. Mm-hmm. Never live separately unless forced to live separately, in my view. So that in some sense, of course, you know, we have lived together for good or ill, wherever Jews have been in the world.
What's perpetual in this history and what's not? I mean, I look at the timeline at the back of your book and it's one expulsion and massacre after another. Does that stop? Is there some 3,000 years from now, maybe there'll be two volumes utterly different from your two volumes. Is that possible?
I don't know what that alternative would look like. I certainly hope that it would look like something which didn't have quite so much calamity, you know, staining the pages. But anti-Semitism seems to be on the rise again, so I wouldn't be automatically optimistic about that. What is perpetual is to find a way to, wherever you live, and this includes the Middle Eastern too, to sort of find a way to live with your neighbors while not compromising the essence, the absolute core of your religious and ethical teachings. And, you know, that says something about how we organize humanity. If we organize humanity around a set of ethical instructions and teachings and debates, that's a part of humanity we can feel good about, I think.
There's a wish, maybe even a prayer to go on, that we might yes. succeed in that.
Indeed.
Simon Schama.
Not entirely over the rainbow.
No. Well, let us hope not.
Down
here, too. That would be just fine. Yeah. Simon Schama's five-part series has been on public television, the first of his big two-volume text of history, the story of the Jews finding the word 1000 BC to 1492 AD is out. Simon Schama, it's always a pleasure to have you with us. A good week to you, a good Passover, and thank you for joining us.
Happy Easter.
Thank you very much. In a moment, Pope Francis, Holy Week, and the Catholic Church. This is On Point. Pope Francis keeps making headlines. This Holy Week is no exception, delivering his strongest condemnation yet of clergy sex abuse, taking selfies with crowds, including women and Muslims, in a ritual foot washing, giving kids rides on the Pope Mobile. Francis has very quickly emerged as a remarkable pontiff. We wanted to look at his impact in this Holy Week. Joining me now to take a look is Father James Martin, a Jesuit priest and editor-at-large of the national Catholic magazine America, author of the new book, Jesus, A Pilgrimage. Father James Martin, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Here we are, just a year and a couple of months from that moment that most of us will remember. Everybody seemed to tune in to see him come from the parted curtain at the Vatican, the new pope. Has there been a pope in history, in recent history, that has, in such a small period of time, made such an impression, not just on Catholics, I think it's fair to say the world?
Well, I would say you could make the same case for John the 23rd and John Paul II, you know, who really sort of burst onto the public scene. But I don't think they did so quickly. I mean, as you said, just within the space of a year, many people's view of the Catholic Church has changed radically.
Here's just a little bit of the sound of the enthusiasm among Catholics here. After delivering an off-the-cuff homily on Palm Sunday, Pope Francis mingled with a very excited crowd in St. Peter's Square, taking pictures with many. Here you can hear young members of the crowd shouting to the Pope, "Selfie, selfie," and he did have selfies. Selfie, selfie, selfie. And here yesterday, the Pope meeting pilgrims in St. Peter's Square, kissing babies, waving to screaming members of the crowd. Father James Martin, what exactly is eliciting this kind of reaction from this Pope?
Well, I would say two things. First of all, you get those reactions really from anyone, you know, who's seeing the Pope. John Paul, Benedict, they had those kinds of crowds. But I think in Francis, you're seeing this response of someone they find authentic, someone who lives simply, someone who is very down to earth, someone who speaks their language, and someone they really feel warm to. So I think it's that kind of extra warmth that people feel towards him personally.
Is it making a difference in the lived life of the church, of the Catholic community, just for starters? Are there more people in the pews? It's been a tough, rough patch for the Catholic Church. Do you see people coming back to the church? The hierarchy of the church has not been popular. In particular, is that changing?
I do see a big change, and people are coming back. I'll tell you the story of a friend of mine who is gay and who has felt estranged from the church for the last few years. And he called me a few months ago and said, I've registered at my parish, thanks to Francis. And then a few weeks ago, he called me and said, I went back to confession for the first time in a couple of years. So, you know, these are not just anecdotal things. People do feel differently, and it is making a difference.
The foot washing this week, this is something of Holy Week, and yet here's a Pope who embraces tradition and yet kind of challenges some real conservatives at the same time. How so with his foot washing?
Well, he is washing the feet of not just priests, which was the done thing for a long time in Rome, and not in the great cathedrals in Rome, which was also the done thing, but he's today going to a center for disabled and aged people, and he's washing the feet of men and women, including a Muslim man. So I think it's fantastic. I mean, it's a real sign of service, and, you know, he's emulating what Jesus did at the Last Supper, which is wash feet and show us a model of humble service. So I think he's emulating Jesus, which is what the Pope's most important job is.
And he has taken on one of the most difficult issues the Catholic Church has faced, which he had spoken to, but never quite so forcefully as just in the past few days. The Pope asked forgiveness from victims of sexual abuse by Catholic priests on Friday. He was talking to the International Catholic Child Bureau. Here he is interpreted by the Boston Globe.
I feel compelled to personally take on all the evil which some priests, quite a few in number, obviously not compared to the number of all the priests, to personally ask for forgiveness for the damage they have done for having sexually abused children. The Church is aware of this damage. It is a personal, moral damage made by them. But they are men of the Church. We are not going to take a step backwards as far as the treatment of these problems goes, nor as far as the sanctions that must be imposed. On the contrary, I think we must be very strong. You don't joke around with children.
Father James Martin, help us unpack this a little bit. What has pushed Pope Francis's own commentary on this abuse scandal forward here in his own remarks and maybe in contrast or beyond what's been said earlier by his predecessors?
Well, it's hard to say what's pushing him other than the sort of accumulated realization that all priests know and all bishops and popes know that this scandal needs to be addressed squarely. I think what's different is, he's speaking very personally, as I think you said, it was off the cuff. And he said, I take responsibility. I'm taking this on myself. I apologize myself personally. And that is something, as far as I know, that we have not heard before. And I think that, it's something that has to be addressed. And I'm glad he also said we're not taking one step backward. To me, that was very strong language.
What does he mean exactly by that? I mean, some would say, the toughest critics would say the church hasn't gone far enough forward on this. What's he mean when he says we won't take a step backward?
Well, I think he means he's not going to undo any of the changes that we've done. So, for example, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops has safe environment programs, meeting with victims that bishops and cardinals have done. So, yeah, I think a step backwards would be if someone were to suggest, we've done enough of that, or we don't need that any longer. And I think he's saying, no, we're not going to do that, and we're going to go further. So, I think you cannot pay you cannot focus too much on this problem because it's a huge crisis, particularly, right now. And I was glad that he sort of addressed it forthrightly. And he also appointed a high-level commission at the Vatican, which included a woman who was a victim of abuse. And so I think these are all good steps.
The Roman Catholic Church, of course, is looking right now, revving up for the canonization of Popes John Paul II and John the 23rd. Later this month, that's a whole subject in itself. What about this Pope and his standing in the church already after just a year and some time in the Vatican? What do you think he means to the Catholic Church at this point? And is he becoming a figure of religious, spiritual significance beyond the Catholic Church at this point?
He is. I know non-Catholics who like him. I was speaking to someone yesterday who said that Francis reminded him of someone like the Dalai Lama, someone whose appeal crosses religious boundaries. I think he's an enormously important figure for the church, and I think that just by being who he is, a simple, down-to-earth Jesuit, he's drawing a lot of people back to the church, and more importantly, back to God and back to Jesus. That's the whole point. And anything he can do to draw people back to God and back to Jesus is, great in my book.
Do you see him as a conservative Catholic with a kind face and tone or a reforming Catholic?
I think those categories are actually not pertinent in the church. I see him as a good Catholic and someone who is showing us the face of God, and that's got to be a good thing.
Father James Martin, editor-at-large at the National Catholic Magazine America, Jesuit priest and author. I wish you a good Holy Week, Father Martin. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Same to you.
Listeners, thank you for joining us today. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. See you there. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.